content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family, and we wish to thank them for their support. And this is a story I'm looking forward to, not a story, an article I'm looking forward to reading to you. Before There Was Jazz, The Innovations of a Forgotten Genius Who Laid the Groundwork for America's Signature Music. On March 9, 1819, a supremely gifted musician named Francis Frank Johnson played a concert at the Masonic Hall on Chestnut Street in Philadelphia. Johnson and his bandmates were free black men. The audience was white and well-to-do. The building was a monumental Gothic Revival masterpiece with a towering steeple. Johnson, a 26-year-old composer and multi-instrumentalist, was already a sensation in Philadelphia. A book about the city published that year described him as the leader of the band at all the balls and inventor general of cotillions, a dance craze that was overtaking the city. The author, Robert Waln, W-A-L-N, a former U.S. representative from Pennsylvania, also marveled at Johnson's flair for reinventing a sentimental song into an irresistible foot-stomping jig or reel. At some point during the show, the hall caught fire, the flames climbed up through the walls, and the mighty steeple collapsed, though no one was hurt or killed. And while the fire was started by a newly installed gas jet mounted too close to a flammable curtain, many Philadelphians enjoyed speculating that Frank Johnson's hot music had ignited the blaze. Hotness is a quality often associated with ragtime and jazz. Louis Armstrong's first bands in the 1920s were called the Hot Five and Hot Seven, and it derives from making the rhythm more propulsive while stretching out certain notes. Was Johnson playing an early prototype of jazz, a century before its recognized birth in New Orleans? Experts are divided on that question, but all agree that Johnson was a major figure in early American music. Renowned for his inventive compositions and his virtuosity on wind and string instruments, as well as on the pianoforte, he broke through racial barriers, becoming the first black musician to have his sheet music published, run a training school for other black musicians, and tour widely in the United States. And in 1837, he was the first black American musician to take a band to Europe, where some historians say he played for Queen Victoria. Johnson was famous all over the United States, as well as in Canada and Great Britain, but he was almost completely forgotten during the 20th century. Now his star is rising again as musicians dust off Johnson's compositions in an effort to bring his dazzling music back into the culture. Rodney Marsalis, from the illustrious New Orleans jazz family, first heard about Johnson upon moving to Philadelphia in 2006, and just fell down a rabbit hole with this guy, as Marsalis learned. Johnson had more than 200 compositions published, including cotillions, quadrilles, waltzes, reels, operatic airs, military marches, and quick steps. Marsalis, a trumpeter, was particularly struck by the composer's ability to appeal across racial lines. Johnson was the first black musician to perform in integrated concerts with white musicians. That really drew me to him, Marsalis says. He believed there's one human race, and music is the thing that brings us together. That's why it's so important to bring him back to life. Little is known about Johnson's early years. It is often stated, without evidence, that he was born on the Caribbean island of Martinique. More persuasive is a baptismal certificate from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Philadelphia for a Francis Johnson, born June 16, 1792. The church was in the Society Hill neighborhood where Johnson lived as a teenager and adult in a free black community whose members were welcomed by the white rectors of St. Paul's. By his 15th birthday, having mastered the flute, piccolo, violin, bugle, and pianoforte, Johnson was playing in Philadelphia taverns and was soon hired as a fiddler at a predominantly white social venue called the Exchange Coffee House in an old mansion on 3rd Street, where he built up a huge following. His fans were delighted at the breadth of his repertoire and his highly danceable revamps of older songs in 1810, when Johnson was 18. George Willig, a Philadelphia-based music publisher, heard him play at the coffee house and asked him to write some original music. The result, rather, was Bingham's Cotillion, a piece named after William Bingham, the former owner of the coffee house building. It was the first musical composition published by a black American. That same year, a new instrument called the keyed bugle arrived in Philadelphia. It was tough to play with finger-operated levers that opened and closed the tone holes, but it afforded much greater possibilities for musical expression. After several years of practice, Johnson was the nation's foremost master of the keyed bugle and developed a technique of singing through the horn while playing it. When he performed his compositions, Philadelphia Fireman's Quadrille, audiences were astonished to hear his bugle cry out, "Fire!" He could also impersonate an ice cream vendor hawking his wares and use his flute to mimic a canary. Johnson explored all the musical forms of the day, including Mozart's concertos, Irish jigs, and black sacred music. He wrote a series of works in the Spanish Andalusian style, composed military marches, and led a military band of free black musicians. One of Johnson's most ardent admirers today is Homer Jackson, a visual artist who heads the nonprofit Philadelphia Jazz Project and has used public spaces to stage pop-up concerts of Johnson's work. When you look at the pictures of Frank Johnson, he looks so beautifully composed, supremely confident, Jackson says. He reminds me of Miles Davis that way. Jackson does see Johnson's music as a precursor of jazz. He definitely wasn't composing jazz, but the notes on the page are not the whole story, he says. When he performed, people described his playing as inventive, with embellishments, distortions, and soul-stirring energy. When we performed his pieces, it was so easy to see how you could get happy with that music in the African-American way and make it swing. In 1819, Johnson married Helen Eppo, a Society Hill seamstress who became a successful costumer, milliner, and tailor. It appears the couple had no children. When he was playing military or society events or practicing or composing, he would give lessons in their house. One student recalled that Johnson's music room was filled with instruments, with thousands of compositions on the shelves, and in one corner, an armed composing chair with pen and inkhorn ready, and some galopades and waltzes half finished. To expand his musical knowledge and no doubt to seek adventure, Johnson decided to go to Europe. In November 1837, after a series of fundraising concerts in Philadelphia, the four-piece Francis Johnson Band sailed to Liverpool, England. No one had any idea how Europeans would respond to black American musicians. When they got to London, Johnson rented a performance space at the Argyle Rooms on Regent Street and announced a series of twice-daily concerts in the newspaper. Great novelty, first time in Europe of the self-taught men of color. To intensely curious crowds, they played selections from Rossini, Mozart, and Bellini, along with Johnson's original compositions and his new arrangement of God Save the Queen. One attendee said the band was equal to the best musicians in Europe. After a stint in Paris and a summit with the Austrian composer Johann Strauss in London, Johnson returned to the U.S. His homecoming concerts held at the Philadelphia Museum in the Christmas week of 1838 were a smash, drawing crowds of 3,500 people for several evenings in a row, with many more turned away at the door. He was a beloved, celebrated figure in Philadelphia, in high demand for white society events. But Johnson wanted to break new boundaries and see new sights. In 1842 and 43, Johnson and nine black band members embarked on the longest tour undertaken by any American musicians in the early to mid-19th century, and it turned him into a national celebrity. They traveled on riverboats and stagecoaches and drew record crowds and rapturous reviews in New York, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, Kentucky, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. They also clashed intermittently with the forces of white supremacy. In St. Louis in December 1842, they were served with warrants and charged with being free Negroes within the state of Missouri without a license. A local firemen's association, which had hired Johnson's band to perform at its anniversary ball, engaged a lawyer to defend the musicians, who played sold-out concerts every night as motions and appeals were filed in court. When the circuit court adjourned for its Christmas break without reaching a verdict, the band departed for Kentucky and Ohio. In Allegheny City, Pennsylvania, they faced racist violence. A mob assembled outside the concert venue and attacked the band members in the streets, hurling stones, brickbats, rotten eggs, and racial epithets. Several musicians were badly hurt, but the band showed its mettle by playing the second night of its engagement. Returning home to Philadelphia, Johnson resumed his normal schedule of playing, composing, and teaching until late March 1844, when he fell desperately ill. 2 weeks later, on April 6, he died at 51 years of age from a ruptured aortic aneurysm. His funeral drew one of the largest crowds of mourners ever seen in Philadelphia, and his band played a dirge that Johnson had composed 12 years earlier. William Henry Fry, a composer, music critic, and editor of Philadelphia's Public Ledger newspaper, delivered the eulogy. His talents as a musician rendered him famous all over the Union and in that portion of Europe which he had visited, while his kindness of heart and gentleness of demeanor endeared him to his own people and caused him to be universally respected in this country. Johnson's slide into obscurity was not immediate. 20 years after his death, a historian named Louis Madeira noted Johnson's very considerable celebrity and master of the keyed bugle. In 1884, in a history of Philadelphia, Thomas Scharf and Thompson Westcott similarly highlighted Johnson's fame and importance to American music. But then, according to Johnson's biographer, Charles K. Jones, all 19th century references to him were quietly swept from the ages of 20th century editions of standard music history books for more than six decades. In the early 1960s, Richard Wolff, a musicologist, rediscovered Johnson's story while researching his three-volume Secular Music in America. Still, among the general public, Johnson remained about as obscure as ever. Today, though, the Philadelphia-based movement to restore Johnson's reputation proceeds apace. Rodney Marsalis is performing entire concerts of Johnson's music with his brass band, and the Library Company of Philadelphia staged a recent exhibition about Johnson. Brian Farrow, a musician and historian, has been performing some of the great composer's music, and Homer Jackson is planning further tributes, not just to Johnson, but also to the free black musicians whom Johnson schooled in his style of playing. Asked how folks should remember Johnson today, Jackson says, as a tributary of jazz and an American superstar. And coming up next, So to Speak. So being spelled S-E-W, So to Speak. Beloved by her pupils, Leah McGuire stitched her way into liberation. Most 19th century school mistresses are long forgotten, but Leah McGuire of Pennsylvania, known as the Madam, embroidered her own legacy. She taught her teenage sewing pupils to replicate her flamboyant style on their blank linen squares, with blocked borders, brassy colors, and eruptions of the tricky technique known as Queen's Stitch, visible in the upper corner acorns of this 1828 sampler. Working in a typically anonymous art form, Leah's girls boldly spelled their own names in thread, and their teachers too. It was really important that her name be on there, along with some kind of pious Bible verse, says Jennifer Van Horn, a University of Delaware art historian. At a time when women had almost no control over legal documents and played second-class roles in literature and the arts, Leah's samplers were tools of reputation building. Indeed, the sewing teacher's reputation was often sorely in need of restitching. The name that her parents traced with their needles would change multiple times. Born Leah Bratton in Delaware, the virtuoso married Francis Gallagher in 1791. And as Leah Gallagher set up shop in downtown Lancaster, Pennsylvania in 1797. Her customers were the daughters of the city's fast-rising middle class. Whereas working-class women created samplers as a demonstration of their proficiency for prospective employers, the samplers stitched by well-to-do girls were typically more decorative, used more costly materials, and acted as signifiers of their gentility, says Susan Brown, a curator in the textiles department at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. Yet, as the madam busied herself burnishing adolescent reputations, her own public image took a major hit. In 1802, she filed for divorce. The reason? Her husband's impotence. When it emerged in testimony that the marriage had not been consummated, Francis Gallagher struck back. Caution, he wrote in a newspaper advertisement, warning local merchants that he would not foot the bill of the woman who hath absconded from my bed and board without any lawful clause. In a subsequent letter to the editor, he accused Leah of adultery and of trying to kill him. To save herself from defamation, Leah and her brother rebutted in the press, saying she'd been a much injured woman, and denouncing Francis's long-continued unmanly deception. What the parents of Leah's pupils made of these developments is unclear, but Van Horn writes that an atmosphere of spectacle and gossip descended on the school. Perhaps that's why two samplers from 1802 appear without her tarnished moniker. The next year, though, her restored maiden name, Bratton, graces multiple embroideries, indicating that she was able to resume teaching almost immediately after her public humiliation, Van Horn writes. By 1805, she had achieved her desired legal status of femme sole, a free single woman who could manage her own affairs. Snipping ties with Lancaster, Leah moved to Harrisburg and married again to a quiet shoemaker, Isaac McGuire, taking his name. They opened a popular school with plenty of students to embellish Bible verses. Why did local parents overlook Leah's past? By then, as checkered as her trademark borders, perhaps not all the salacious details followed the maiden lady, the 45 miles from Lancaster. Or maybe by then her body of work was proof enough of her worth. Even today, textile scholars consider her samplers among the finest of their form. Certainly, Leah's students found her immensely fun, fond of loud clothing and fantastical headdress. Of every variety of flowers, she played the fiddle at parties into middle age and urged the young folks to dance, when was thought to be very fine, one contemporary observer noted. By the 1830s, sewing schools in the Northeast went out of vogue. The emergence of the public school system in the 1840s meant that girls from all classes could attend, explains Amelia Peck, decorative arts curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Sewing became a crafty pastime. This 1828 sampler, and there's a picture in the page, is among the last we have from Leah's school. The student who made it, Anne E. Kelly, has even conjured smoke with her needle. The lone maid in the center, bedecked in flowers, tending the fire and generally running the show, is likely inspired by a biblical or classical character, but it's possible to see a glimmer of the sewing teacher in her too. The madam, the maiden lady, the femme sole. And see if we can get in this next article. Fight of the Century, a new graphic novel takes readers inside a match that shook America, by Brandon Tensley. Jack Johnson was known for his patient boxing style, allowing his opponents to tire themselves out, then punishing them brutally once they'd run out of gas. With his uncanny timing and devastating blows, he became the first black American to win the World Heavyweight Championship in 1908. After that victory, many white commentators, including the novelist Jack London, fumed over Johnson's success and swagger, and agitated for Jim Jeffries, a white former heavyweight champion, to emerge from retirement and put Johnson in his place. The big moment came on Independence Day, 1910, before a crowd of 20,000 spectators in Reno, Nevada. In perhaps the most famous 15 rounds in American boxing, the out-of-shape but still formidable Jeffries took on the 6-foot-200-pound Johnson, nicknamed the Galveston Giant, after his Texas birthplace. Last on his feet, a graphic novel written by the American poet Adrian Machika and illustrated by the Moroccan artist Youssef Dadi. See the two panels above. Oops, I can't show you that. I don't see them myself. Revisits this fight of the century, which wasn't just a landmark in athletics. It was a crucible for the racial animosity black Americans had to navigate during Jim Crow era. Through a stylish mix of prose, blank verse, and illustrations, Last on His Feet captures these tensions with unsparing poignancy. Johnson's parents were enslaved, so he was from the first generation of black Americans to grow up supposedly free, said Machika, who in 2013 published The Big Smoke, a celebrated collection of biographical poems about Johnson. But his brilliance, his idiosyncrasy, and his adeptness in the ring were terrifying to certain white people who wished to maintain a rigid social order. In the end, Johnson bested Jeffries, an outcome that triggered racial unrest in more than one city. When Johnson died in 1946 at 68, having lived the unapologetically extravagant life of a true celebrity, the headline on his obituary in the New York Amsterdam News, a black-run newspaper, recalled the disdain many Americans had harbored toward the great fighter. They hated Jack Johnson, for he feared no human. Resisting the Nazis, the Vienna Agent, March 2023 edition, told the story of Muriel Gardiner, the only American woman in the Austrian resistance. It's also worth remembering Mildred Fish Harnack of Milwaukee, who accompanied much in the German resistance. An author and educator, she, along with her German husband, Arvid Harnack, was active in a resistance group known as the Circle. They both were executed in a Nazi prison. Fish Harnack's works is detailed in the 2021 book All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days by Rebecca Donner. And that's the sound that we're going to wrap it up for this edition of Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We thank them for their support. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Just about anything you hear at the Reading Service, you can find online at ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions for us, call us at 919-832-5138.